Chapter 14. Come to Zion. An editor should be reliable in word and deed, adroit, wise, apt in discerning the public need, in rebuking the private evil, and unselfish in doing it. Mary Baker Eddy, 1903. On May 30th, when Mrs. Eddy's article, Now and Then, appeared in the Sentinel, an article appeared in the Literary Digest of the same date, which attributed the origin of Christian Science to Ralph Waldo Emerson. Immediately, Mrs. Eddy wrote a refutation, Miscellany, page 304, which was published in the Boston Journal on Monday, June 8th, with the title, Mrs. Eddy Corrects a Misstatement. A good deal of discussion ensued in the public press, which caused Mrs. Eddy hastily to write a second article, which, without proofreading, she immediately sent on to her editor with this note. I appeal to you in my need and for our cause. Will you examine this that I have not time now to look over? Make it right where it is wrong. Punctuate it. Take it to Farlow, and see that he puts it through the best papers in Boston, New York City, and into the Associated Press. In great haste, with love, M. B. Eddy. Mr. McClellan did her bidding, and what is titled, quote, A Plea for Justice, end quote, in Miscellany, page 305, was published widely. The second paragraph begins, Far be it from me to tread on the ashes of the dead or to dissever any unity that may exist between Christian Science and the philosophy of a great and good man, for such was Ralph Waldo Emerson. And the enemy used the New York Sun to strike at the woman. The Sun changed her word dissever to discover, which totally changed the meaning. The Leader wrote her editor on June 18th, I see the need of arming and fortifying against the enemy as never before. Publish that article of mine, published in the New York Sun, that for, quote, dissever, end quote, printed, quote, discover, end quote, and comment sharply on such an abuse. Again, the enemy can fire and will through the press, but they cannot heal who lie. If we beat in this battle, it must be through demonstrating above their ability. I started this great work and woke the people by demonstration, not words, but works. Our periodicals must have more testimonials in them. The Sentinel is of late a Shakespeare without a Hamlet. 3 pages of testimonials are the least to have in the Sentinel. Healing is the best sermon. Healing is the best lecture. And the entire demonstration of Christian Science. The sinner and the sick healed are our best witnesses. At that date, the Sentinel was a publication of 16 pages, including the front and back covers, so 3 pages was a large portion of the copy. McClellan did increase the space devoted to testimonials in future issues. However, he did a very poor job of correcting the Sun's abuse. As soon as she received the proof for the next issue, the Leader wrote him again. The Sentinel must not be issued with the present arrangement of the reply to an insult to your leader, to her students, and to our cause. It is tame, and the editor assumes, as editor, no responsibility of thought on such a matter of importance, even in this editorial. Place my article as I wrote it, first, then follow it with the New York Sun's shameful publication of it. Make the heading a sharp allusion to said word, that he supplied, and not as my order. But the proper indignation of the editors of the Christian Science periodicals, and make it in a way that will not invoke discussion, but stop it. Get Mr. Willis to prepare, if need be, and hand this letter to him. In great haste and with love, M. B. Eddy. The editor-in-chief had expressed no indignation at the insult to the leader. Hence her suggestion that he turn the matter over to John B. Willis, assistant editor. Sad to say, the Sentinel was already printed with Mrs. Eddy's article, not as she wrote it, but copying the New York Sun's shameful publication of it. This was followed by McClellan's tame comments and editorial. Mrs. Eddy's letter to her editor gives us a much clearer picture on this issue than do the files of the Christian Science Sentinel. It also shows how her officials failed to uphold the leader in her work. Most of the time, all of the upholding fell upon her own shoulders. A brighter note was heard in Concord while this was going on in the press. The final meeting at Christian Science Hall, held on June 3rd, was very largely attended, and there was a natural regret at the thought of parting with this dear historic building, this beautiful hall, which had been a headquarters for scientists from all lands. All hearts were cheered by the announcement that other churches in Concord had offered them temporary shelter for their meetings during the course of construction on their new edifice. The Concord Evening Monitor stated, quote, "The Unitarian Church has extended the privileges of their beautiful edifice so long as it shall be needed. This permission has been accepted," end quote. The continuity of the Christian Science meetings in Concord was appreciated and of public interest. But the practice of Christian Science in Concord, which was not seen, was expressed in a letter from the leader to the first reader, Reverend Tomlinson, shortly after their last meeting in Christian Science Hall. Quote, "I ask that you and your sister and all the practical, good Christian Scientists in Concord each day, twice, take up in prayer the solemn subject that no accident nor harm shall come to those employed on our church building." End quote. A bylaw had been amended earlier in the year, changing communion in the Mother Church to the last Sunday in June, which meant that it would be June 28th in 1903. Extensive preparations were being made for this annual event. The most significant and far-reaching occurrence of this communion season was the first appearance of a new volume added to the literature of Christian Science. Among the announcements for all the meetings and various activities in the Sentinel of June 27th was the following. The New Concordance. A complete concordance to science and health with key to the scriptures is now ready for delivery. In the excitement of Communion Week, it is possible that the great importance of this new volume was somewhat overlooked at its first appearance. But its inestimable value, immediately recognized by the scholar, was soon seen by all real students. Several issues of the Sentinel contained announcements that Mechanics Hall would be headquarters for all the visiting scientists in Boston for a week, beginning Thursday, June 25th. The executive members, formerly first members, met in the Mother Church on Saturday morning, June 27th, and the next day, three communion services were held at Mechanics Hall. Although Mrs. Eddy had announced that there would be no message to her church this year, she did send them a short message. Miscellany, page 133. She also sent these instructions regarding this message. It is multum in parvo, so I take the liberty to say it is at the mercy of the reader. The style of reading needs to be conversational. I want you to select the best reader you can find to read my short message, one whose voice is ample, articulation distinct, and whose emphasis, pause, tone is according to conversation, to the laws of understanding his subject and making it clear to the hearer. The man selected to read her short message was the first reader, Professor Herman S. Herring. Let us hope that he read it with more understanding than the typesetter for the Sentinel, who put, quote, lessons, end quote, instead of, quote, lessons, end quote, in her closing lines. Truth happifies life in hamlet or town. Life lessens all pride, its pomp and its frown. Love comes to our tears like soft summer shower to beautify, bless, and inspire man's power. Near the close of the communion service, Professor Herring read the leader's message, which began, quote, my beloved brethren, I have a secret to tell you, end quote. All were interested in her secret, and all were delighted a short time later to receive an invitation to visit the leader at Pleasant View the next day. All who could possibly do so availed themselves of the invitation, for 10,000 or more made the trip to Concord on Monday, June 29th. The Boston Evening News editorialized, Boston is used to conventions and big gatherings. Possibly for that reason, the feat of the Christian Scientists in filling Mechanics Hall three times on one Sunday for a strictly religious service has not attracted undue attention. But even Boston is not accustomed to seeing 7,000 or 8,000 people arranged within 8 hours for an all-day excursion, have tickets printed and issued, and special trains engaged inside that time, and actually be on their way before the invitation to go was 24 hours old. That is something that usually follows weeks, even months of careful planning. And yet the Christian Scientists did it in hours. Moreover, everything went as smoothly as if the details had been worked out by rule and rote. Not even a railroad official lost his temper, and there was not the semblance of an accident reported. The vast gathering was handled, both in Boston and in Concord, by the volunteer ushers of the church. They did the policing and the directing. The people themselves did the rest. Whatever one may think of Christian Science, whatever he may think of this visit to Concord, which outsiders persist in terming a, quote, pilgrimage, end quote, and which insiders say was nothing of the sort, its success as a mere exhibition of how a crowd can be handled and can handle itself is sufficient to classify it among the extraordinary events of the moment. Aside from the satisfaction of seeing Mrs. Eddy and hearing her speak, the characteristic of the Concord visit, which most seemed to please and impress the Christian Scientists, was the hospitality with which they were received by Concord itself. The city threw open to them its doors, even the doors of its clubs and private residences. A conspicuous leader in this particular was the Wannal Lancet Club, whose spacious house in the heart of the city was placed absolutely at the disposal of the scientists. To how many promiscuous gatherings of excursionists from all over the world would the Wannal Lancet Club care to throw open its home without restraint? We all have our little weaknesses, and Christian Scientists may have theirs. But it would appear from a candid examination of their case that they also have some qualities which are worth almost anyone's emulation. At least they know how to conduct themselves like ladies and gentlemen when they go on excursions, and that of itself is a bit of a virtue. More than one newspaper reporter was greatly impressed by the gathering of 10,000 people on the lawns of Pleasant View. Frank W. Gale, a practitioner and teacher from California, was one of the many busy men directing the people and carriages as they arrived. One of those arriving was an accomplished and well-known photographer from Concord, Mr. W. G. C. Kimball. Mrs. Eddy was his friend, and though she could not spare time for photographers, she gave Mr. Kimball her permission to take her picture if he could do so without inconveniencing her, which he had done on several occasions. Mr. Kimball had asked on this occasion if he might photograph Mrs. Eddy on the balcony. At first, she had declined, but then said if he would stand at a distance and not distract the visitors, he might take a photograph. The reporter from the Boston Herald wrote, "By noon, the thousands who had come from Boston and others who had journeyed to Concord from other points awaited admittance. Shortly before 1:30 p.m., the gates opening on the street were thrown back, and the crowd passed through, seeking the places nearest to the east balcony from which Mrs. Eddy was to address her guests. The time for her appearance had been set at 1:30 p.m. It was just a little before 1:30 when one of her corresponding secretaries, young John Carroll Lathrop from New York City, entered the leader's room to ask her a question. She invited him to remain in her room and listen to her address through the open window, and then called her maid to put on her wrap and bonnet. The Herald reporter wrote, quote, "When Mrs. Eddy came out on the balcony, her appearance created a profound impression," end quote. John Lathrop said, quote, "A multitude of joyous, upturned faces greeted their dear leader in a stillness indescribable," end quote. Mayhap Mr. Lathrop was reminded of the passage, quote, "And I, if I be lifted up, will draw all men unto me," end quote. According to the Herald, Mrs. Eddy looked over the throng for a moment. advanced to the front of the balcony, and with hands folded in front of her, began to speak. Her words came clear and distinct. Mr. Kimball took his photograph. John Lathrop said that he was later informed that every word was heard as she spoke slowly and distinctly. Beloved brethren, welcome home to your home in my heart. Welcome to Pleasant View, but not to Varying Views. I would present a gift to you today, only that this gift is already yours. God hath given it to all mankind. It is his coin, his currency. It hath his image and superscription. This gift is a passage of Scripture. It is my sacred motto, and reads thus, quote, "Trust in the Lord, and do good. So shalt thou dwell in the land, and verily thou shalt be fed. Delight thyself also in the Lord, and he shall give thee the desire of thine heart. Commit thy way unto the Lord. Trust also in him, and he shall bring it to pass. He shall bring forth thy righteousness as the light, and thy judgment as the noonday." End quote. Beloved, some of you have come long distances to kneel with us in sacred silence, in blessed communion, unity of faith, understanding, prayer, and praise, and to return in joy, bearing your sheaves with you. In parting, I repeat to these dear members of my church, trust in truth, and have no other trusts. With emotion manifest on her face, she looked smilingly upon the thousands of upturned faces, and waving them goodbye, passed within. Her face was radiantly happy as her maid removed her wrap and bonnet. She sat down in her big chair, folded her hands, and said, "Wasn't it a wonderful occasion?" Then she asked John, "What are they doing?" He looked out the window and told her they were having silent prayer, to which she responded, "We will pray too." "Now what are they doing?" she asked. Someone had started singing, "Shepherd, show me how to go," which spread quickly to the farthest corners until the strains were swelled by 10,000 voices singing in unison. The communion hymn was also sung, and the Lord's Prayer repeated. After repeating the scientific statement of being from Science and Health, the throng began to disperse quietly. Then Mrs. Eddy said to John, "Now I will see what God says about it." As she did on every occasion, every day, she picked up her Bible and opened it at random. And God said to her, quote, "And the ransomed of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with songs and everlasting joy upon their heads. They shall obtain joy and gladness, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away." End quote. "See how God is always with me," she said to John. "That verse I will add to my address." So when her brief address was printed in the Sentinel, it ended with the verse from Isaiah, preceded with the leader's words, quote, Today is fulfilled the prophecy of Isaiah. End quote. Mr. Kimball was not expecting much because of his poor vantage point when he photographed Mrs. Eddy on her balcony. When he developed the film, it was just about what he expected. So he tossed it among the discards. At a later date, when going through his discards before disposing of them, Kimball again discarded the balcony scene, then took one more look and decided to enlarge it. And lo, the balcony portrait. Many years later, Reverend Irving C. Tomlinson and his wife visited Mr. Kimball at his studio. As the photographer told them the story of this famous picture, he said, "It was lucky I didn't throw it away, for the balcony portrait has brought me more business than all the others put together."